From UFOs to psychic powers and government conspiracies, history is riddled with unexplained events. You can turn back now or learn the stuff they don't want you to know. A production of iHeartRadio.
Hello and welcome back to the show. My name is Matt.
My name is Noel.
They call me Ben. We're joined, as always, with our super producer, Alexis, codenamed Doc Holliday Jackson. Most importantly, you are you, you are here, and that makes this Stuff They Don't Want You to Know. It's the top of the week, which means this is our strange news segment. We always find a little something off the beaten path, and we bring it to each other. We'll turn over these ideas. We often will find more questions than we find answers.
That is very true today, with especially one story that we've already kind of touched on, but now we're learning more, and just our brains are reeling.
Hey guys, a quick question. Now, I know we're doing video now, and this is like a new thing for us kind of in this format at least, but when you've got the Zoom open and you know we're doing video, do you find yourself looking at your face and like trying to be more animated? Is this like an active process that you guys have to go through? Because it is for me. I'm just putting it out there. I'm like, I want to look like a human. I don't want to look like a robot. And so I try to look more human. Yeah.
Yeah, it's funny because as we were gearing up to record, I don't know if you were here, we're off air setting up the Zoom call, but I was saying the exact same thing or a very similar thing when I was saying, does anybody else find yourself looking at the little thumbnail of your face when you're in one of these calls and then you're kind of nodding or watching your own reactions? Zoom is terrible for narcissistic tendencies.
Yeah.
The species is going to be even worse at the end of this.
I have some good news, bad news for you, Ben. I am not looking at your face at all for reactions. Very distracted by what's happening just behind you, over by the door.
Oh, that's right. An Easter egg for our video friends. Yes, I am the reason we started late today, or should I say our returning video accomplice. You know her, you love her from the YouTube days. That is indeed Agent Scully. Took some convincing, but she's joined us in the studio. As you could tell, she's snoozing one off right now, but hopefully we'll get her back in the mix. As soon as we realized we were returning to our video roots, we knew that we couldn't do this without her. So also to our super producer, Doc. Thank you for just letting us roll with this when we were like, now there's a skeleton in the mix.
Gillian Anderson has not aged well, you guys. She needs to eat a burger or something. It's good to have her back. Her? Him? I don't know, guys. This is before my time.
I did some research into things you can tell about skeletons to try to figure out the biological, the biological sex. We're fairly confident Agent Scully is female or was in another life. But we held a vote for everyone on YouTube, and we just want to thank everyone who tuned in and participated in that vote for not giving her the name Alex Bones, which we were very close to.
We made it through.
And speaking of making it through, let's see, we've got some good ones today. Where do we want to start? One of these is like my personal hobby horse, so I feel completely biased when I'm like, oh, I'll go.
Well, I kind of want to save it, if that's okay.
Totally,
Ben.
Yeah.
If you guys are down, I wouldn't mind getting into this firsthand, if that's okay.
Lead the way. This is something, Matt, when you first came to us with this, this is something that I was unaware of, and it's a disturbing story, especially in the implications.
Yeah, I would say a lot of people were probably unaware of this story. I certainly was until I went digging around a bit. And it's possibly because it almost feels like local news, like terrible, tragic local news, but something that occurred in one specific place. It dealt with one individual, I guess, who wasn't especially prominent. We have to remember that there are tragic things that occur and horrific things that occur every day across the globe, and, organizations we're going to talk about this a little later, organizations, news organizations, get to decide what is newsworthy for you to learn about, and then has to go through a whole other process of getting into the social media that you may be consuming, or, you know, in whatever pipeline of content that you're consuming. So there are several steps through which a story has to travel before it gets to your eyes or your ears. And this is a story that comes out of a place called Flower Mound, Texas. It's just south of Denton, Texas. If you look at a map, you'll see the it's the Dallas-Fort Worth area, and then Denton is kind of north of those two in a bit of a triangle. And then just below Denton to the south is this area called Flower Mound. And I'm just going to read you from this story that comes from the Dallas Morning News. This was published on August 18th, so a little bit before we're recording this. I'm just going to read it to you. Flower Mound police are investigating an 18-year-old man who was fatally shot Tuesday morning. Officers were called just before 6 a.m. to a home in this area of Flower Mound, where they found Matthew Thane dead. No one else was injured in the incident. Police said they were working to identify a suspect and added that the shooter was reported to have been wearing a helmet. This is not believed to be a random act, according to officials, and police said they have no reason to believe the attacker is still in the area. So this was published again on the 18th. That was a Tuesday night. That was the day that Matthew Thane was slain. He was 18 years old. Well, we know, we've learned quite a bit since that initial published story, but just on the surface of it, a young man was killed. And that is very sad, no matter what the circumstance. And our, you know, of course, our hearts go out to, you know, the family and friends of Matthew Thane, the victim. The reason why we're talking about it today is because Matthew Thane did something that a lot of us probably do who are listening right now. I would say a good number of us do. And even more of us participate in it without actually doing it. Sounds a little vague. Matthew Thane was a Twitch gamer, a Twitch streamer. So he would play video games and others would watch as, you know, he is playing his game. He would interact with people watching. And in part of his interactions, like a lot of other streamers, there can be some things that happen that aren't maybe the nicest. Some people call it cyberbullying. Some people liken it to other things. But there is a lot of times in those environments when you have a streamer who's on one side of the camera and then a lot of viewers on the other side of the camera, there can be tension there. And it's something that humanity is learning to deal with, I would say. We're evolving, right? We're evolving in our interactions online. We have been since we had the ability to type something up and somebody else across the world could read it. Right.
Sure. Yeah. But I'm just laughing because I wouldn't conflate that with positive progress in all senses. Right. We're finding new ways to ridicule each other's mothers, to threaten each other. Yeah. Like, I see what you're saying, though, because we are communicators. It's one of our primary superpowers as a species, but I just feel like we're also seeing a lot of very ugly things.
Yeah. And I mean, we've talked about this a lot, but just the whole nature of anonymity on the internet really empowers the worst impulses in people a lot of times, where they feel protected, and the ability to kind of target people or bully people or dox people or do any number of like internet based kind of scare tactics, really. I mean, it's almost like internet, I don't know, I don't want to go too overboard, terrorism, like where you can really terrorize individuals, and it can spill over into the real world, I think, which is what I think you're getting at here with this story. And it freaks me out because, I mean, talk about growing up on the internet. I think the three of us were sort of like came in when dial-up was still a thing. That's when we were younger. And then, you know, cable modems and DSL is what really like cracked all that wide open. So we certainly, you know, we evolved kind of along with it. But like my kid, just literally has grown up on it, and it's just second nature. And like, that's the way, especially with all this remote school, basically the exclusive form of how she gets her social interactions in. And she's very aware of all of this stuff and cyberbullying and being able to protect her identity and protect her, you know, actual personal details, because there's always, you never know who's, even if it's someone you think you're friends with, quote unquote, what's the criteria for having an internet friend? You don't really have to vet them that heavily, you know? I mean, it's not the same as knowing somebody in person and maybe knowing their family or knowing things about them and how they behave in real life, you know?
For sure.
Anyway, sorry, I feel like we derailed you because you were definitely going somewhere.
It's okay. Well, who knows? Who knows with me, you guys? We might be going somewhere. We might just be coasting and then looking around at all the weird things occurring. That's generally how I like
wherever we're going, we're along for the ride, man.
Okay, perfect. So Matthew was a Twitch streamer. According to some social media posts by the family, he went by JPN. That was his tag, or Japan. And according to the family, Call of Duty was one of the main games that he played. And for anyone who's unfamiliar, it is a warfare game that has evolved over the years, where it is a first-person shooter where you take the perspective of a person with a gun and you fire at other players, and you generally score points, I guess, and are victorious by killing more people than your opponents. This game and others like it, as we've talked about on the show before, have been criticized heavily over the years. A lot has been written about them, about whether or not they can affect psychologically those who play them. You know, we've discussed this at length about how much validity there is to some of the thinking there. I believe we came away from this kind of on a middle ground, where it does it doesn't appear to have a direct effect, but there is something to be said kind of on the periphery of our understanding even about what these types of games can do to us. Again, because just as in our online communications, this is evolving as well. Like the experiences that we can give each other through video gaming and virtual reality experiences and all these things, we're really just learning it. We're in our infancy of these things.
And importantly, the research since we've had that conversation has changed. I keep track of this stuff. We have to remember this kind of communication, this medium, is evolving so quickly, and it's so relatively new that we don't have the luxury of, say, a intergenerational or 50-year longitudinal study saying something like Group A was raised with Call of Duty or whatever, and this is the activity in their brain compared to Group B, which was just raised with the things you know and love, boomer audience of insert science journal here, checkers and I don't know, man.
Parcheesi. Or, you know, if you look at my all of my games over here, maybe just Risk is at the bottom there. Mm-hmm. Maybe you just played that game.
Well, I have a quick question for you guys. Like, I mean, Call of Duty has obviously been around for a long time. You know, there's a lot of iterations of that game. I don't know the answer to this, and I'm sure there are tons of super young people that play it. But do you think the youngest of the young gamers are more playing things like Fortnite and what's that other one that's a little more cartoony and a little less like real life, you know, shooter? What's it called?
Smash Brothers? Minecraft?
No, I love that. No, Minecraft for sure, but talk about in the shooter realm. Matt, Overwatch.
Apex Legends?
Overwatch is the big one. I feel like Fortnite and Overwatch are the big ones for the younger crowd. And I definitely know young people play Call of Duty, and there's a big one that just came out, this Warzone or whatever. And I have found, though, that whenever I tried getting into Call of Duty, and I just find that a lot of people that are on there are really mean. Not only that they will snipe you from like miles away and just like, you know, totally harass you just in the game, but they're just like, they use a lot of kind of racially charged language and like a lot of homophobia. Yeah, no, definitely. And maybe that's internet in general, and I'm just naive because I don't play a lot of games with just like open anyone that can be on is on. But that's kind of the nature of those. And I was shocked one time where I had Call of Duty on and I quit the game, but it was still connected to the chat on my TV. I didn't realize it. And all of a sudden there's just like this just string of like, you know, homophobic expletives coming out of my TV. And I was just like, oh my God, like my mom was over. But I don't know. Like, do you feel like there's a I don't know, a division with like the with age, like with like Call of Duty versus these other games that are a little less overtly bloody and that are a little more like, creative. I don't know.
I don't think so. I mean, maybe there's a general trend, but having the agency to choose the game one personally wishes to play means that there will be demographic trends, but ultimately every person as a unit of the gameplay can make their own choice. There are people who are into all kinds of weird things that might really surprise you, right? But I think Call of Duty here is mainly important because we're talking about Matthew Thane.
Yeah, right? We're talking about Matthew Thane being shot at his home. And the reason why it's significant is because the authorities are investigating. They're not 100% sure at this point, at least according to the reporting that I've seen on this, but they are investigating whether or not Matthew's death was related to a gaming dispute, specifically within Call of Duty, within the realm of Twitch streaming that Matthew was doing. So there's another story that was published on August 21st that is a follow-up to Matthew's death. And the title of this article is Flower Mound Teen's Killer May Have Driven from California to Settle Video Game Feud, authorities say. I'm going to read a bit of this again from the Dallas Morning News. This was written by Tom Steele. The now dead suspect in the slaying of a Flower Mound 18-year-old may have driven from California to Texas to settle a dispute that began in a video game. Officers were called shortly before 6 a.m. Tuesday. This is about Matthew's death, to find Matthew. According to a police spokesman, the attacker lured Thane outside by setting a propane tank at the back of the home on fire. Police said at the time the gunman was wearing a helmet, and they had no reason to believe that he was still in the area. And I just want to stop here for a second, because in a lot of these games, the objective is to strategically kill more people than your opponents, right? And the strategies used to do that a lot of times have to do with flanking, with setting up something like a distraction, doing things very similar to what appears to have happened in this real-life example where a young man was killed. The concept of setting a propane tank alight in the backyard to get your intended victim outside to then shoot him, I mean, that sounds like video game thinking to me.
Totally.
And that's why perhaps it is, if true, if you know what the police believe is true, then this would be just this would be terrible and terrifying.
Yeah, it's interesting because when you told us about this, there does seem to be a suspect, right? So it goes to the question of I guess, verisimilitude, because if we spend a lot of time mentally in one place or in one state, then we start to transfer that perspective into the waking world. A less complicated version of this tendency can be seen with Tetris. One interesting thing about the game of Tetris is that, you know, it's built to be addictive. It's built to get to fire those right parts of your brain and get you to continue playing. And after a certain threshold, an overwhelming majority of people start saying that they just sort of think and dream of the shapes of Tetris. And with Call of Duty, or with any game, really, the question of which game is which is kind of irrelevant. What we're saying is if you are inundated in this virtual environment, then everything else sort of starts to become visible through that lens, even when you're unplugged. And this, I don't think they have identified any kind of suspect outside of an age, right? An age range?
No, they have identified a suspect.
They have. Okay, who is? Do we have the name?
Yeah, I do not have a name at this point. We know that it is a 23-year-old California man that was at least an acquaintance or an online acquaintance of some sort to Thane, to Matthew. And apparently this person, after they investigated Matthew Thane's home, they identified this person as a potential suspect who was way out in California.
Yeah, I guess that's what I'm saying. I say they've identified him only by age or a location. I should have been more clear and said they haven't publicly announced this suspect's name.
Correct. Correct. Absolutely. Yes. So they identified that this person may be involved. Police in California went to Pleasanton, in the town where this 23-year-old suspect lived, and they obtained a search warrant for this man's home. And when they got there, they discovered that he had committed suicide by gunshot in his home, or at least it appears that he had committed suicide in his home. And allegedly, this was as the officers were approaching his residence.
Jeez.
That's when he killed himself. The official cause of death has not been released. Again, that is what the authorities have stated, that mm-hmm. it's appeared to have occurred. Mm-hmm. And this article from the Dallas News there also says that the Flower Mound police said evidence recovered from that home was linked to Matthew Thane's death. And they would release more info after confirming that the California man was, in fact, the killer.
It's 25 hours, by the way, depending on which way you go. Yeah. So you could do the turnaround quickly. It'd be pretty brutal. It makes you wonder. They probably stopped halfway somewhere. But
well, I mean, it occurred that Matthew Thane's death occurred on Tuesday evening or on Tuesday. And then he was found in his home the next day in California. So he literally drove from California to Texas to do this and then drove right back.
I wonder if it was one of those situations like that. Remember that astronaut situation? I can't remember her name, but she drove with a diaper on like a really long distance to confront her like a ex-husband or something like that. Mm-hmm.
It wasn't as far of a distance, I believe. Her thing was planning. Astronauts are meticulous planners. So yeah. her thing was planning to minimize her drive time, basically, because if you have enough gas, then, you know, bio brakes and the unfortunate design flaw of sleep are the only thing keeping you from going continually. But when people have mania or when they're having a break of some sort, time does get different. You know, time is not, you don't experience fatigue in the same way, I would imagine, at least subjectively. Objectively, your body is still wearing down, right? We know that. But now they're saying there's more evidence coming out or that they will have more announcements in the next few days. What do you think is going to become of this, Matt?
You know, I'm unsure for Matthew Thane's family and friends. They're forced to deal with the death of a loved one, and for whoever this attacker was, the killer, they are also having to deal with the death of their loved one. And the real question here is what caused this to occur. And, you know, how many other people out there are dealing with some frustration or issue that this killer was dealing with, you know, that perhaps could be, perhaps, and I can't speak for everyone in every situation, but perhaps could be handled with just a little personal connection or somebody to talk to work through something like that.
Well, sure. You know, it certainly seems like a case of undiagnosed or possibly diagnosed and just acknowledged in this situation in terms of how it escalated mental illness. You know, I mean, to have that level of fixation based around a game, which can, you know, exacerbate those kind of things if you're prone to isolation or if you're prone to depression or if you're prone to kind of delusions of grandeur or whatever. Like, it certainly is something that can really push that stuff to the next level. Like, I have a friend who, you know, struggles with depression and has found a community in online gaming. And sometimes it's like you just disappear into it and it becomes your whole world. And if something in that world triggers you or someone wrongs you within the rules or that are established by this basically fantasy existence, it can have real ramifications in the real world. And sometimes people might just hurt themselves. In this case, both things happen.
I got very, very strange messages when I was working my way up the ranks of Tekken Online. just because it seemed cheaper than going outside. People do have personal, like, I don't think we need an anecdote because everybody listening to this show, this is a podcast or this is on YouTube, you know someone who has experienced this. You may have experienced this. There's nothing wrong with loving a game and getting very into it. I don't want to put my own narrative on this, but it sounds like we're asking what else might be out there. Is there going to be maybe a trend, or is there already a trend of things like this? But I don't know. I mean, maybe that's completely not what you were thinking, Matt, but I just keep remembering, you know, almost every mass shooting we hear about in the US, especially in earlier years, there was some kind of video game angle that an anchor or a pundit would sort of put on it. You know what I mean? Like the teens in Columbine. But to your question, Noel, is playing these games, you know, it's correlation versus causation, right?
Right.
Were they
right.
just playing because they were already trying to escape some very painful circumstances or some very troubling states of being or invasive thoughts? I don't think we can play them a video game.
No, I mean, and not to be too silly about it, but it's like I play a ton of online Mario Kart, and I'm not going to go driving around thinking that I can shoot turtles at people or like slip on banana peels in my, you know, sedan.
But on the other hand, I can't be the only person who every so often just like checked the handles of locked cars and parking lots after playing Grand Theft Auto 5 for too long. It just felt like the normal thing you would do. Yeah.
No, it's true. It's true. Well, it'll be interesting to follow this. I don't know. Like, it seems like it's case closed. I know there's a GoFundMe campaign for the young man that was killed. That's almost met its goal. You know, to raise money for funeral expenses and obviously just to help the family. If you want to check that out, you can go to GoFundMe and look for Matthew Thane Memorial. And they've raised $23,649 of a $25,000 goal.
Which will hopefully be higher by the time this comes out.
I'm certain of it. Just as a closing piece here, I don't know if you can see this on the video here, but this is Call of Duty Mobile, and I play this game absolutely every day. Nice. And I love competitive games like this that are first-person shooter that have violence in them. I want everyone out there listening to not feel weird for enjoying a game like that. I don't want you to think that we're talking down to you for liking those kinds of games.
No, they're awesome. What are you talking about?
Well, I know. I just want you, I'm speaking directly to you, whoever you are. Just remember, you know, that is not, you know, it's not reality. It's wonderful. It's fun. And anything that occurs in those games, no matter how much it feels like it's affecting you right now, I promise you, you're going to be okay. And, you know, reach out. Talk to somebody if you need any help whatsoever. Just want to leave everybody with that. And if you do want to find me, I'm on Call of Duty Mobile. I'm STDWITK, just like our number. If you want to play a game, let's play a game. Add me. Let's do this. And let's be competitive and have fun. It doesn't have to ever lead to something like that.
Agreed. And on that note, why don't we take a quick sponsor break and then come back with some more strange news.
And we're back. I believe our next story addresses some similar ideas about life in a virtual world versus life in the analog or biological one. And this is part of something that I am convinced has to be a full episode in the future.
Yeah, and with that in mind, I think we'll probably just touch on it a little bit because it's a really interesting, divisive issue where I'm not even quite sure what to make of it yet. And I think we're all kind of on the same page. But it's about Facebook and the way it's sort of battling with this notion that it is either, on the one hand, anti-conservative or, like, you know, actively it's an argument that a lot of conservatives make about Silicon Valley in general and things like Twitter and, you know, all of these platforms, that they're actively filtering out conservative or more right-wing viewpoints.
And then on the other hand, there's a lot of discussion internally from employees at Facebook that they are actively pro-conservative. And that's really interesting. And it's not about the political bias, whatever. Like Ben was saying, it would be just as troubling if they were actively being anti-liberal or anti-left-wing or anti some particular issue. The idea is that they're supposed to be an arbiter of free speech and that they shouldn't be playing favorites one way or the other. So the politics part of this is really kind of just secondary to just the amount of control that a company like Facebook has, especially when you consider the fact that, like, I mean, let's be real, guys. Facebook is a monopoly, you know, over our information. The fact that they can just kind of buy up competitors that are developing things that they want to be in control of, you know, intellectual property, technology. Like, they basically just bought up Instagram for a gajillion dollars. I'm not quoting. That is just a, you know, a guesstimate. Because they wanted to have that technology. They wanted to have that platform for themselves rather than develop something themselves and compete in, like, a free, fair market kind of way. So that part in of itself is a little bit troubling. And this control over information, especially during an election, that's probably going to be the most remote election in the history of elections in terms of people not wanting to go to the polls, in terms of people, you know, using mail-in ballots and absentee ballots more than ever before. And there being this potential lag in, you know, when the ballots are cast and when the results are in. And so it's a big topic, and we can just kind of divide it up a little bit into a couple of buckets, I guess. One is about the fact-checking program that Facebook has. And there's an article that BuzzFeed published on August 13th by Craig Silverman and Brian Mack. The headline is "Facebook's Preferential Treatment of U.S. Conservatives Puts Its Fact-Checking Program in Danger." So let's just really quickly talk a little bit about what this fact-checking program is. It's essentially a rank that supposedly third-party fact-checkers give to the veracity of articles, content, whether it's false or misleading or inflammatory or overly, what's the word, sensational, I guess. And that can include things like ads that are pro-choice, that maybe have images of fetuses or things that are, like, you know, meant to trigger you and could be considered inflammatory, or things like fake news, the idea of reporting something that isn't true or is patently false or is somewhere in the middle. And Facebook has been caught essentially kind of messing with those stats in terms of, you know, which sites get rankings cleared more quickly. There was like a case of a Breitbart article where their internal flagging system, you know, flagged it as being potentially false, and then someone within Facebook removed that flag by the end of the day, and the article was allowed to stick around. So let's start with the whole idea of flagging content and having independent fact checkers and where that problem lies if there's no transparency.
I think there's a major issue here, and it's a problem that is very much an onion that you have to begin drilling down into, right? First of all, we're talking about social media platforms where in human beings who are using it supposedly have, at least if they're operating within the United States and its territories, they have First Amendment rights, which means they can say whatever they want, right? Anyone can say whatever you want, essentially, right? To an extent. But then you drill down a little bit further, we have social norms that we've all adopted that vary, you know, in on an individual level, but, you know, overall we've decided what we can and cannot mention, or beliefs that we can or cannot put forward as our beliefs because they are taboo or they're out of bounds or so incorrect and against what the whole believes, or at least the majority believes, that we just cannot type them or state them. Then you get down even further, then you're talking about institutions. Like, I think there's Prager. This is one that was mentioned in a BuzzFeed.
Right. Yeah, Prager University.
Mm-hmm. Like an institution who is that is making a statement, right? That appears to be a fact and may not be a fact. We have to decide like on which of those levels and where do we want to draw the line, right? Should everyone be able to say anything they want to say? If no, then should institutions? I don't know. I think like if we don't address that first one, right, the free speech angle, then how do you get into any of the other things?
But there's a difference here because these are private entities, so they own their own lawn. You know what I mean? And
yeah.
The people invited to Cavour, just walk with me a second, because this is a crucial argument that hinges on something in the Communications Decency Act, Section 230, aka it's the reason, I don't know if this is in the article you were looking at, Noel, but it's the reason that Twitter and Facebook and all their ilk have not been sued into oblivion.
Right.
The reason they haven't been obviated, and it's the idea that they are simply a platform for other people's ideas. So if somebody, for instance, posts something hateful and discriminatory on Twitter, Twitter's not getting sued for hate speech, right? Because of this kind of legislation. Interestingly enough, earlier this year, the current president of the U.S., as we record this, Donald Trump signed an executive order trying to get Section 230 removed because he wants, because he likes it if he feels like it gets along with him, and he's angry if he feels like it disagrees with him.
But isn't that basically the basis of the free and open internet? Like, without that, there's going to be so much potential for litigation that no one's going to be able to publish anything. No one's going to be able to share any free thought because these platforms are going to be on the hook for everyone else's ideas. And therefore, they're going to be so protective of who gets to post on their platform that you're not going to have access to anything beyond just whatever the most safe line is, right? Isn't that the idea?
I would argue that's not a bug. That's a feature for the group that continually has wished for a less free internet. I mean, the same people who want your website browsing to be sold to you the way tiered cable packages were sold by Google Premium, by Bing Signature, I guess.
Doesn't that also limit, like, I mean, look, again, the politics is secondary here, but, you know, we know Trump has made some inflammatory statements that were fact-checked and proved to be untrue. Doesn't that limit his platform of choice being Twitter, and his ability to, like, go on there and say whatever he wants and then have that freedom of speech? Doesn't this shut that ability down for him?
It's part of it's a noodle in a larger spaghetti dish of terrible, terrible things. Honestly, the argument about upon whose shoulders the liability for hate speech or incitement to violence rests. You know what I mean? I've said it for a very long time. There are more and more things to look at, right? But there are fewer and fewer people in charge of the screens that let you see those things, right? It's like Disney. What did Disney buy today while we were recording this?
God only knows.
Did they buy, like, my cats? Did they buy the idea of all cats? Maybe.
Right. I'm literally going to go to DuckDuckGo right now and see what did Disney buy recently.
Is that like Ask Jeeves? What is that? I love this.
Are you going to DuckDuckGo?
Yeah. Is that a thing? Yeah, is there a reason to use that search?
Yeah.
Tell me.
It gives you Google without all of Google's clingy information gathering aspects.
I learned something new today. I didn't know this. This is great. Thank you, guys.
It's been done. Yeah.
No.
It's still consistent.
It looks like Fox is the last thing.
Okay. All right. Well, that was a big one. Really quickly, and then we can totally move on. I just wanted to go into a little bit about this whole process that they have, because I sort of brushed over it early on. But they do have a set of third-party fact-checkers that assign a rating to these pieces of content. Based on those ratings, Facebook applies a label, and it can be demoted. The content can be demoted, which I think is kind of like search engine optimization. Like, if you're quote-unquote putting out low quality content, you get demoted in the search rankings. So I think that's similar to what this is, what's going on here. But they also have a system of strikes against their preferred news partners, which again is folks like BuzzFeed, The Washington Post, and yes, Breitbart. And in this article, there's a discussion that's going on in this internal Facebook platform called Workday or Workforce, I think is what it's called. And a lot of employees were wondering why Breitbart is allowed to continue being one of these preferred news organizations when they consistently have published misinformation. There was an article, or a video rather, that got, I think, 14 million views in about 6 hours because of how prominently it was promoted on Facebook. And it promoted mask, like the idea that masks weren't necessary, put forth some dubious science behind that. And it was actually removed from Breitbart's page after being challenged enough. But in that period of time, it racked up all those views. That would be considered a strike. And Zuckerberg said that this is a strike, but we're not going to demote them because they've only had one strike in the last 90 days. But then internally, there was some evidence that these strikes were cleared by some unknown individual within that has access to the system. And again, like you were saying, Prager University, a couple of other ones. Let's see. There was also Diamond and Silk, Charlie Kirk, Turning Point USA, some other kind of farther right wing outlets that were kind of having these black marks stricken from their record in an effort to kind of game the system.
Well, just to step in here, we've talked about this before. We have to remember this. Facebook, as much as you want it to be the place where you connect with your family and that's what it's meant to be, no, Facebook is an advertising and data collection platform. That is what it is. That is what all social media is. Doesn't matter how much you love it, what you think it is, they are designed to make money for the people who design them by selling ads to all of these bigger corporations. Mm-hmm. It doesn't matter where they politically lie. If their ad dollars are good and those checks clear, good to go. And of course, any company can have a mission statement and values and all of those things, however they want to play it, or at least publicly put out there. But in the end, it's the bottom line for those. And you got to remember that no matter what is written in those ads, no matter what's shared on those posts, that data can then get gathered up and sold to a bulk buyer,
sure,
like a third party.
And the terms of service can change without your consent or without notifying you. And is as innocuous as this stuff might seem. Shout out to everybody who wrote in regarding the yes or no's of DNA collection, especially on Here's Where It Gets Crazy, our Facebook page. Blackstone just bought Ancestry.com. Da-da-da-da-da-da. Boom. So with this point, you know, you're right. These private industry institutions and companies, they are capitalistic endeavors. They would not exist if this were not the case. And with the consideration of that, I would like to point out also, and stop me if we mentioned this and I somehow missed it, back in 2019, Facebook announced their plans to pay Breitbart for content.
Right.
They were paying these other publisher arms, and it was messaged out as a way of giving them extended security in these our uncertain days. But that gets us to another sticky issue with journalism and accuracy in reporting. If we're paying these things to churn content for us, and then we're also saying with the other hand that we are somehow walking away from money, right? Most of Facebook's money is generated by the engagement of people reading stuff they see and reacting to it, whether or not it's real, doesn't matter to the bottom line, to your point, Matt. So now they have these conflicting aims. And what price do we put on the truth? By the way, I'm not the 100% fan of Section 230. I think it's a real dilemma, because if we don't hold these platforms responsible in some way, then there's nothing stopping them. Other than business leaving, there's nothing stopping them from doing whatever the hell they want. So you do have to have some sort of fact checking. But I think to your point, Noel, it's who prioritizes what is considered a fact and when it is considered a fact.
That's right. And also just the murkiness of the whole process. You know what I mean? Like they say, oh, we rely on these third party fact checkers, but we really have no insight into the process, especially if, you know, at the end of the day, they're not held to these standards. It's just an optical thing. Like it's literally saying, no, we have these different organizations, media outlets that have different viewpoints that are giving us unbiased, fact checking. But who's to say that they have to abide by that? You know what I mean? It's not something that's not like it's a law. It's not like there's some kind of legislation that's holding them to do this. It's all internal. And the thing that really confused this issue for me, speaking of internal stuff, and then we'll move on. There's another article that came out today just a couple of days ago. Facebook commissioned a study of alleged anti-conservative bias, and here's what it found. And it was done by a former Republican senator by the name of John Kyle his colleagues at the law firm Covington and Burling LLP, and they looked into this notion that you know, frankly, has been put forth by members of the Conservative Party and folks like Donald Trump that Facebook is patently anti-conservative or anti-right-wing. And the study found that they had taken some measures to, for example, it really leaned more heavily on things like anti-abortion ads that often have very triggering kind of upsetting images of whether it's fetuses or people that are sick or, you know, hooked up to hospital equipment and something that would maybe be, you know, triggering to some people and unpleasant and the idea that it's inflammatory. They have adjusted their policies or their auto image, you know, recognition things to allow images of people with medical tubes as long as they're not in visible pain or distress and there are no blood or bruises. And that's something that could benefit folks who post ads for pro-life organizations and also children's advocacy groups advocating for, you know, protection against child abuse and things like that. So the article, again, this is an internal study. It doesn't really talk much about the fact-checking process at all. It's much more about the idea of filtering out content that has a right-wing lean. So it's really weird. But again, this is internal. So this is all clearly kind of for optics as well, because they hired this person. They commissioned the study themselves. They're not forced to abide by it. There's really nothing that anybody can do short of doing some kind of antitrust situation against Facebook as an entity. Like, who's to say that they can't post misinformation anytime they want? Who's holding them to these standards except for themselves? So I don't know the answer.
It's really a messed up situation, you guys. I personally don't want anyone believing or living their lives based off of misinformation or disinformation or something that is untrue. Unfortunately, we've all been doing that to some extent throughout our whole lives because we don't get to control the pipelines and we don't know a lot of times exactly what is occurring in the world around us. And there are people out there that want it to be that way.
No, 100%. But I mean, I think at the end of the day, and this is something that I tell my kid to do is, and God, even my mom, but that's a whole nother story. You got to vet your own facts. I mean, you can't just rely on one platform to tell you what's what. You have to do independent fact checking. You can't rely on these fact checkers that Facebook hires or employs or uses or whatever that arrangement might be. You got to just do your own homework and keep your eyes open and not let the wool be pulled over your eyes or actively pull it over your own eyes.
Well said. So expect more from us on this in the future, and expect one more piece of strange news after a word from our sponsor. And we are back with Kim Jong-un, aka one of the reasons, it's hard for me to wait for this episode, but one of the reasons I was able to take out my old DPRK flag that I bought near the border. And that's what Agent Scully is reclining against. I don't think you can see it very well. But we brought Kim Jong-un with us in the news today. we reported, Matt, I really appreciate you taking the time to set that up with a little teaser at the top of the episode. That was very, that was cool. Thank you. I hope it pays off. But we recently reported on the ascension of Kim Jong-un's sister, who has been taking over more day-to-day operations for the so-called Hermit Kingdom. This place, for a long time, was kind of a black box for the world's intelligence agencies. They didn't know very much about what went on there on a daily basis, but they did know that the DPRK did not have oil, so they didn't invade them. And eventually, they got nuclear capability, which is another kind of that and not having oil are two, not foolproof, but they're two things that really lower the likelihood of another country invading you. By which I mean the U.S. They lower the likelihood of the U.S. invading you. So people have always speculated about Kim Jong-un. And when we did our original report about him being missing in action, we said one of the theories was that maybe he had faked video footage, right? Because his debut back from his absence was like a press kit of him at a fertilizer factory. Footage that could have been filmed at any time, right? And this led a lot of the pundits and the boffins and the eggheads and the wonks in the crowd to speculate like crazy, like mad, and say, well, this is a body double, and this is just the kind of dictator that would do this. He is sick. They don't want to show weakness to the domestic demographics of North Korea. And then other people said, no, he's dead. And someone else said, no, he's not dead. It was a heart attack. And then someone else said, no, he's been in a coma. And so we started talking a little bit, you'll recall, about films like The Death of Stalin and ideas of creating these body doubles. Like we did a pretty interesting series on actual body doubles. They are a real thing. Unfortunately, a lot of them have very painful lives that get cut short. But the news that came out in recent days from one specific source is claiming that, yes, the crazy speculation was right. Kim Jong-un's recent appearances were faked, that he has been in a coma, quote, for months. And so I did some digging on this because anybody who's read about North Korea for any length of time, you know that the propaganda is so strong. A lot of South Korean outlets and a lot of Western outlets especially will just report whatever they think someone had heard. And it becomes an echo chamber of people slightly rephrasing the same story that later turns out not to be completely true. And I got to tell you, I understand it because when I've been at the border, the propaganda, the thing I wish they told more people in the U.S., the propaganda is really, really strong on the North Korean side, and it's really, really strong on the South Korean side, like very, very bad and blatant. And you have to watch this informational video at some of these tourist sites, and they're all about how the DMZ is great for birds.
Right. I remember you talking about that.
And that's like a really positive contribution it makes to biodiversity. Anyhow, that's the idea. The report comes from one Jang Sung-min. He is important because he was a former aide to President Kim Dae-jung in South Korea. He was head of the State Affairs Monitoring Office. He probably had access to intelligence operations, SIGINTEL, HUMINTEL. And he insisted recently, Kim Jong-un is comatose and his sister, Kim Yo-jong, is still running a lot of day-to-day stuff, but she is not technically his successor. He's saying the insiders haven't made that switch yet. But the problem is a lot of people are calling these sources into question. This is a retired political official who was, you know, you would know him the way that you know a member of Barack Obama's presidential staff or Donald Trump's presidential staff, right? You've probably heard the name. Maybe they went to jail for something. I don't know. That's U.S. right. Politics. But this guy, I'm saying, is more like a career career politician, bureaucrat kind of guy, not necessarily James Bond himself. And now people are not just on the civilian internet, but people in academic circles and people in intelligence agency circles are trading notes on this. The Twitter is hilarious. There are tons of people saying, no, he's fine. It's propaganda. It would have been more widely reported if it was true. This is one guy claiming one thing. That Kim Jong-un had been seen as recently as August 19th. But we have to realize that we are in the post-deep fakes era, which means that now more than ever, as Fox loves to say, it is possible to fake the appearance of someone online. And if you're a state actor with the resources and the motivation, it is possible to do it very well. Like, the thing that should scare people about that concept, I'm not saying that's what's happening now in North Korea, but the thing that should scare people about that is that it means it's completely possible for your own president or prime minister or whoever rules your country to have a heart attack, to go into a coma, and for their online persona to just continue, just deep fakes of, you know, the regular fireside chat, just keep the Twitter going on brand in the voice.
Or even us.
Or maybe. Matt's doing some eyebrows. Well, people, see, you got to watch the video. You have to watch the video to catch the Frederick brow action. But I wanted to ask you, gentlemen, because we had talked about this before. Do you guys remember that conversation?
I do. Totally do remember that conversation. And I wanted to ask you what you think about something that Jeffrey Lewis said on Twitter, a.k.a. at arms control wonk.
Mm-hmm.
He was citing the last 30 days of appearances by Kim Jong-un. He's citing 10 from, I guess, the official Supreme Leader's Activities list that I'm assuming is issued by some state arm or outlet there within the DPRK. Mm-hmm. And there are 10 official appearances, and I haven't actually clicked on it. I was kind of scared to click on it. I wanted to see where it took me. It's a Google Doc.
He's the one who did the, he's the one who also mentioned the August 19th date.
Okay. Okay. Yeah. But he's got it all listed out there. It would make you think that the level of disinformation and number of appearances there would feel odd to me. Like, right. That's a lot to put out to feign that he's, you know, actually out there using body doubles or deep fakes or whatever.
And it seems like there's a wonk who cried wolf situation so often when it comes to conspiracies about Kim Jong-un's death, because we've seen so many Western sources just directly quote, in a way, quoting themselves, quoting things like Radio Free Asia, which is totally and blatantly U.S. propaganda. Like, it's on the website. They end up quoting themselves, and they seem just like really eager to hear about Kim Jong-un dying. He is a terrible person who has overseen concentration camps, but a lot of the speculation, I think, comes from, again, still this sort of black box situation. Like, the guy travels by train. He travels by rail because it's seen as the most secure way for him to travel. He could die. That's the thing. He could die and have the state apparatus would have the power to make sure that no one really knows for a while. The question is how long, you know what I mean?
Yeah, man.
And what happens? I think that's my next question. Like, for you all, because I know I read a lot about North Korea and stuff, but what do you think happens when the king is dead?
His sister rolls in and runs stuff, and it's way scarier than it's been in a long time. Because I take her seriously.
Yeah, that's what I was wondering. Like, at first I thought, you know, we talked about her on the last time we had this conversation, and she was like watching like 4th of July videos or something, and not knowing as nearly as much as you about this topic, Ben, I was like, oh, is she like more open to Western influence? And like, but apparently that's not the case at all. Like, she's
staunchly anti-Western influence, and like I think she's known to have had people killed that were like dissidents or that were, isn't that right? Like there was a poisoning situation several years back with a diplomat.
Right. Yeah, there have been poisonings. One of the siblings was killed. Another lives a life in exile. From what we understand about the outlook of the country culturally, it's pretty patriarchal, but it also cannot have a power vacuum for any amount of time. Things will go south so quickly, maybe literally south, because South Korea is just over the border. This would be an absolute and utter shit show. But it also makes me think in a larger scale, to your point, Matt, about the multiple appearances that the leader of North Korea has recently had or appeared to have had. Do you all think it's possible that a president or prime minister in another country, maybe like the US or Canada, do you think it's possible they could die or perhaps be mentally infirm or compromised and that we would have enough of an apparatus to hide that fact from the public?
I'm only thinking of the United States, but I'm imagining with the frequency of White House press conferences that occur with the press teams that exist there from outlets across the country, I think it would be near to impossible for the president of the United States to get away with it. Although if you decided that that's no longer going to happen as a regularly scheduled thing, then perhaps, because then it would just be whoever has transparency into the White House itself. And if no one ever came out or went in, and then no matter which president is in the White House, if they were sequestered inside and they weren't leaving for an emergency situation, let's say, you would have no way of knowing. And there are secret ways to get in and out of the White House, too.
Yes. I guess, you know, it's weird because you raise an excellent point, but we also have to consider if something like this happened, it would not be the first time information was hidden from the public. And I don't mean the world. I mean specifically in the United States. Woodrow Wilson had a terrible stroke in October of 1919 with almost none of the technology we have today. He was partially paralyzed. He was nearly blind. He spent the final like 17 months of the presidency. Oh, yeah. He was still president, by the way. Locked away in the White House. He was still president until March of 1921. So the public didn't know. The public had no idea of the severity of his condition or his illness. And to me, given that this is a place with a rule by the representatives of the people, that seems like important information. Maybe there's a geopolitical thing that keeps them from saying that. But I just, what hits me about this, no one talking to the media, at least, seems to really know what's going on in DPRK. There are a bunch of guesses. But also, before we get on a high horse about that, how much, whether you live in the U.S. or abroad, how much do you know about the day-to-day actions of the folks who are responsible for keeping your country running? It should be a sobering thought.
Yeah. Do you guys, is anybody out there listening? Are you in with Five Eyes or Epsilon or any of these other groups? Maybe
Are we still in chance. With Five Eyes? Did they kick the U.S. out yet?
Four Eyes? Are you down with Four Eyes?
I only got two eyes, guys. That's the best I can do.
No, but there are intelligence agencies and world governments that have those satellites over the DPRK. And you know mm-hmm. they do. Just like they True. Do over numerous other locations. Probably everywhere.
Seismic sensors.
That's not being conspiratorial either.
Yeah. It's just, I think it's just easier to get good coverage from a satellite system. You know what I mean? You get more bang for your orbital buck.
Yeah. Until you get the bug-sized, you know, spy cams in there, which mm-hmm. will be everywhere.
And as we always need to mention, when we're talking about surveillance states and having spy cams everywhere, everybody hold up your phone.
Hey!
Hey, get a little...
Oh, no, my tape came off.
I need to get some more tape on mine as well. I was just thinking about that. If you're watching this, this part of the episode is brought to you by duct tape. or electrical tape, you know,
yeah.
some kind of tape to put over your phone screen. I think there are some phone cases that also have a little physical slide. Have you guys seen
those?
Oh,
that'd be clever. I like that. Yeah.
Yeah. Phone tape and rare earth minerals.
And DuckDuckGo.
And DuckDuckGo. And that's our show. Thank you so much for tuning in, folks. We hope that you enjoyed this. We went a little long, but maybe these will just be longer segments because the mission of this show says that we should chase the story and we shouldn't cut things short for some arbitrary timeline. As a matter of fact, if you listen to our earlier episodes last week, you're all too well aware that our species actually has very little idea how time works to begin with. So it's a tough question. But these are great stories and they feel like they're going to lead us to more episodes. The relationship between cognition and communications technology, aka video games specifically, the power and opaqueness of Facebook, and then, of course, North Korea. I'm just going to get that in a t-shirt at some point. And then, of course, North Korea.
That's great. If you have anything to say about any of the things we've discussed today, you can find us on social media, like, hey, Facebook, where we're conspiracy stuff. Or you can check out our community page there. Here's where it gets crazy. Join us, hang out, if you're down to be on Facebook for any time whatsoever. And we're also on Twitter, at Conspiracy Stuff, and we're on Instagram, Conspiracy Stuff Show.
You can also give us a call. Hop on the horn if you hate social media, but you like to shout into the void. It's not really a void. We'll be listening. We have our ears peeled. You can call us directly. We are 1-833, say it along at home, STDWYTK.
Yeah, less of a void, more of an abyssal plane kind of situation. But we definitely reach out into that thing pretty regularly. And now we've got a weekly segment where we mine your calls for use on the air. So let us know if you have a problem with us using your voice or want us to leave out your name or what have you when you call in. And you might just hear yourself on one of our listener mail episodes.
And if none of that quite bags your badgers, but you have an important tale to tell, that's tough on my Tennessee accent, you can always let us know, regardless of what time it is, regardless of what day, what year it is. All you have to do is hop to your internet email arrangement of choice and drop us a line. We are
conspiracy@iheartradio.com. But don't go. Remember, you and all your friends, subscribe. It's either here or it's out there somewhere. YouTube.com/conspiracy stuff. Say it with me. YouTube.com/conspiracy stuff. We are the only thing that matters. I'm hypnotizing you right now.
Good eye contact.
YouTube.com/conspiracy stuff.
Stuff They Don't Want You to Know is a production of iHeartRadio. For more podcasts from iHeartRadio, visit the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you listen to your favorite shows.